Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And with the thousands of young Catholics attending Seek events last weekend, we are happy to have with us John Bishop of Forge. He is the founder and executive director of Forge, a Catholic ministry that is focused on forming strong Christian fathers and rebuilding families by forming men in virtuous masculinity. John holds a doctorate in theology from the Catholic University of America and wrote his doctoral dissertation on masculine virtue and lives in Des Moines, Iowa with his wife and children. His talk on masculinity at the Seek Conference in Columbus, Ohio was met with a standing room only crowd of young men. Or was that in Fort Worth, Texas? It wasn't, because it was different locations this year.
Yeah. So, you know, they had Seek at three different locations, Columbus, Denver, and Fort Worth.
And
I spoke at two of the three.
Ah, I see.
Well, I spoke in Fort Worth and in Denver.
Well, welcome to the show, John. Thank you. And thank you for that clarification.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. I've been to Seek before, but only when it was in a single location. So only in St. Louis or what have you. So we're grateful. You must be exhausted after a lot of travel this past week.
Yeah. Well, it's good to be on the show, and I'm grateful for you guys having me.
So yeah. And well,
just
tell
got
me
back
about
home to Iowa.
Yeah, that everybody's kind of buzzing about the crowd that you drew. Tell us a little bit about the people in attendance at your particular talk.
Yeah, so both in Fort Worth and in Denver, I was very happily surprised. I mean, I think we had a little bit north of 2,000 men at both of the talks. And I think the interest on the part of young men at something like a Seek conference is pretty symptomatic to what's going on in the culture at large. One of the things I spoke about in the talk was the fact that for the first time in at least two generations, the United States has actually seen an uptick in interest in Christianity amongst young men. Okay, so the American Enterprise Institute reported in 2023, for the first time really since the 1950s, that we had an increasing rate of religiosity amongst Gen Z Americans. Now, that's really astounding, because for the last several generations, men have really been leaving the church in droves. So there was a study out of Pew Research about 7 years ago that showed that on any given Sunday in the United States, not only in Catholicism, but in any mainstream Protestant denomination, you'd see on average about 61% females in attendance, you know, at a mass, at a large service, Sunday service, and only 39% males. Now, what I always say when I talk about these demographics is that the declining rate of religious participation by men in the United States and really throughout the Western world is a problem for this generation, but an even bigger problem for the next, because studies do show that generally speaking, kids are more apt to follow the religious practices of their fathers than their mothers, right? And so if you have men leaving the church in droves, that's a bad thing for this generation. It's even more concerning for the next. So praise God. I don't know if we can really say that what we're seeing the last couple of years is really a trend yet. We probably don't have quite enough evidence to really say anything too substantial, but it's certainly positive news, you know, welcome news. And back to your question, the talks that I gave both in Fort Worth and then also in Denver, and the large crowds that attended those talks, I think that's pretty symptomatic of a generation of young men who are looking for answers to, let's say, a generation of young men who have been given a very confused culture and are looking for answers. They're looking for direction. And where are they going for those answers? And for that direction, they're going to the church. So yeah, it was really beautiful.
We really want to flesh out more of what you talked about in your talk, but I was hoping first we could take a giant step back and get your take as somebody who speaks and talks about these issues directly to young men. If you could kind of set the table for us as to what you think is, I mean, you just started to, but really expand on what you think is kind of the state of the young American man. And this is, you know, this is a topic that's vexing a lot of people, and it's a topic that goes beyond just Catholicism. And I don't even want to name names, but there's a lot of toxic influencers who seem to be latching onto this. What is your kind of 30,000 foot view of the state of the young American man?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And if I had the time, I would really enjoy a 5-hour version of this podcast to tell you exactly what I think about that. But I'll paint with broad strokes here, given the time constraints, and hopefully that gives at least a little bit of value to our listeners. What is the state of the American male, and I'll hone in specifically on young American males. Well, I think that the young American male is characterized by a lot of the things, but one of the things that he's characterized by is a distrust of institutions from which his father and his grandfather received guidance. So I think it used to be the case that a lot of men would, young men in particular, would go to their churches, they would go to their schools, and they would look for those places and look in those places for models of masculinity. Men have an inherent need to see models when it comes to their masculinity, and in a certain sense, they have a need that is deeper and more poignant even than their female counterparts, at least in a different way. One of the things that I wrote about quite extensively in my doctoral dissertation was the fact that across cultures, across time and place, you see male initiation rites as a kind of staple facet of any culture, as a way to develop and usher men into a mold of masculinity that can help them thrive in a particular time and place. Now, things like male initiation rites haven't been present, at least in any robust sense, in the United States for a while now. And the rites of passage that used to characterize or used to guide young boys have now, some of them have become woke. So you might think, for example, of the Boy Scouts of America. I'm a proud Eagle Scout myself, but what used to be a place where young boys could kind of, devoid of politics, learn to be young men has now not only lost a lot of its backbone, but even, invited women into the ranks. And that's not to say that women are in any way less than men. I mean, just to be very clear, one of the things that I spoke about in my talks was that the church has always upheld equal dignity, though complementarity in the sexes. But men have lost their way. And when young men perceive the institutions which previously gave them guidance to be suspicious of them, well, they still look for guidance, but they just look for guidance elsewhere. And unfortunately, many of today's young men, if they're not looking in the streets for guidance, they're looking online, which you mentioned, for example, the rise of a lot of influencers, both inside and outside the church, that are, in some cases, like I'm a big fan of Jordan Peterson, for example, I think influenced men in a basically positive way, right? But in other instances, nobody's perfect, but in other instances, you have for example, the YouTube manosphere, as they call it, a lot of characters who I won't name on this podcast just because I don't want to give them any airtime that isn't their due. But a lot of young men flocking to online personalities that are teaching them a brand of masculinity that is anything but helpful. And it's teaching them to, sure, be masculine in some machismo sense, right? Or in some reductive sense that ultimately will lead to their own depression, to increased rates of anxiety, to, God forbid, suicide. And not a wholesome, not a winsome version of masculinity that leads to flourishing and to sanctity. And so a lot of men are looking for guidance. They are finding people who are willing to guide them online, and unfortunately, they're not finding people to guide them in their in schools and in places of worship. So that I think one of the tasks of this generation is to bring men back, and we're starting to see some positive numbers in that direction. But one of the things I said in my talks in Denver and in Fort Worth is that young men shouldn't feel the need to check their masculinity at the door when they come into a church. Right, they should have a churches should feel like masculine places, so that young men learn masculinity there and not online, that they learn masculinity there and not on the streets.
John, I had the great privilege of working for many years for Cardinal Francis George, the late Archbishop of Chicago, and the highest compliment he could pay to any man was to call him a Christian gentleman. And I
Yes.
saw him do that in writing that, John Bishop is a Christian gentleman, would be the highest form of praise. And you've written about what you call masculine virtue. Do you see masculine virtue as being reflected in the Christian gentleman? And when you're speaking to young men, do you feel like they want to be called to be not just masculine men, but gentlemen.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the podcast. I'll give these guys a shout right now. Called The Catholic Gentleman, and I think the term is so perfect. When I speak of masculine virtue, what I'm talking about is essentially the channeling of masculine energy towards a noble end. So in my doctoral dissertation and in a book that's coming out on February 16th called New Adam, where I basically popularize my thoughts from the doctoral dissertation for in a much shorter form for a broader audience, I talk about how deep in the soul of any young boy is a desire not just to be a good human, but indeed to be a good man. You know, young boys, one of the kind of the most crippling things that you can say to a young boy is to liken him in any sense to a girl, right? If a young boy wants anything, he wants to be not girl, he wants to be not feminine, he wants to be a man, he wants to be shown how to be a man. And like I said earlier, throughout history, across cultures, time and place, societies had traditions. They had things like initiation rites that ushered young boys and took that masculine potency, that masculine energy, and channeled it into the strength of a man. You might think, for example, one of the things that is so characteristic of young boys is a kind of a risky spirit that it's been shown in study after study. And if you don't believe the studies, you can follow the, say a 16-year-old's insurance rates to know that young boys are certainly a little bit more risk prone than their feminine counterparts. What do you do with that risk prone spirit, with what, for example, Protestant author John Eldridge calls that wildness? Well, young boys can channel that wildness into, for example, the entrepreneurial spirit of a mature Catholic businessman or Christian businessman, somebody who takes the right risks and who has learned how to channel his risk-prone spirit into a man who risks well. One characteristic you might say of a gentleman is not to be sort of standoffish and to be reserved, but to be the kind of man who knows when to seize an opportunity because he knows the right risks to take. What you have there is the cultivation of I keep circling back to the term masculine potency, to the kind of raw material of a young boy, and not doing away with that raw material, but channeling that raw material into something that is both helpful for the boy, now a man, and also for society at large. Okay. Young boys, young and indeed men are designed to take risks. And so it is behoo of society, it is behoo of the church to teach them how to risk well, right? And you might say the same thing of even something like physical strength. You can certainly say the same thing of sexual desire, of desire to be with a woman, any kind of male raw material, if neglected, will fester and turn into something that is toxic for society. But if it's not neglected and not shunned, but instead channeled, it can become a saintly asset both for the individual and for society at large.
What do you think are some of the key vessels or ways by which currently available to men that they can be formed in the way that you're describing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ashley. And I would say that there are a lot of avenues that are kind of more mainstream and apparent for young boys. They're available to moms and dads to form their young men that are sort of ready at, in any city. You might think, for example, of good, wholesome sports programs that take things like competition and channel boys into men. I'm a big fan of the various different iterations of Catholic scouting that have emerged from Troops of St. George to more localized programs. I think those are really helpful. I also think, and this is really what I've devoted my professional career the last couple of years to doing, is that the multiplication of men's small group programs from Knights of Columbus Corps programs to Exodus 90, and indeed to Forge, my own organization here in Des Moines and also in Wichita, Kansas. What I'm really passionate about is creating small group contexts where men can be vulnerable, not for vulnerability's sake, but can be vulnerable in such a way that leads them to things like breaking addictions, that leads them to genuine camaraderie with other men, to build virtue, to build strong interior lives and prayer lives so that they can be better husbands and fathers. I think that I've been in ministry for a long time, and I think there's a kind of perception in the ministry world that men don't want to get involved in things like small groups. And having worked outside of men's ministry for a long time, I worked at Focus. We were talking about the SEEK conference earlier. I worked at the Fellowship of Catholic University Students for many years, and we always had difficulties getting men involved, as most ministries do. But what I found now working full-time in men's ministry for several years is that men will deeply savor something like a small group context. You just have to do it a little bit differently. For example, in a paradoxical way, men, I think it's critical for any men's formation program, especially a small group one, that a sense of safety and secrecy accompany that small group. And if a man doesn't feel like he's safe, there's no way that he's going to be vulnerable. Men are meant to be protectors. And when those protective instincts go up and they feel as though there's some sort of relational threat, say in a small group setting, then they won't join. But if you have a program, say like Alcoholics Anonymous, that has built a culture of kind of, you know, what is said in the meeting stays in the meeting, men flock to those programs and they become deep sources of change, of transformation, of friendship for their male participants. So I would exhort any man listening to this podcast that if you have a good opportunity to get into a meaningful small group, whether it's through an Exodus 90 program, whether it's through a Knights of Columbus Core program, whether it's just a men's small group at your parish or getting one together with your friends, I would readily encourage you to that's just kind of where the money's at. It's what Jesus did. He got a small group of men together. They changed the world. It might be a cheesy thing to say, but it is, I think, the kind of privileged route for transformation, especially in our post-Christian era.
So, John, over the last couple of decades in particular, we've seen a huge surge in the number of young people, men and women alike, identifying as LGBTQIA++, a huge rise in transgender issues and people identifying as transgender. How do you think and this was kind of unheard of. Of course, you know, there have always been people with same-sex attraction, but 30 years ago, there were not, 20 to 30% of grade school kids saying, that they were a different gender than the one they were born with. What do you see as the role of Forge in bringing back some common sense and sanity to that particular piece of the puzzle in terms of masculinity? And do you feel like, are you seeing in your own experience, men actually wanting to discuss this issue with you and how to respond to it?
Yeah, so there's a lot of good questions in there, and so I'll kind of take them one at a time. First off, Mary, you're so right. The absolutely unprecedented rise in young men and young women identifying somewhere along the LGBTQ, XYZQ, X squared plus, spectrum is astounding. And it's really, perhaps it should have been predictable 15 years ago. The line at first when it came to advancing, quote unquote gay marriage in this country was that that same-sex attraction was seemingly for any person who struggled with it a static condition, right? That was unchangeable and that nobody else could sort of morph into it either. Well, when you have a culture that is rife with woke propaganda, and when you have a culture that drinks in pornography from a very young age, the plasticity of sexuality and the way in which it can easily be manipulated seems to have come to the fore here in our times, and it's deeply depressing. The number of men who I personally have encountered who struggle with some sort of sexual dysmorphia or whatever you'd like to call it is really depressing. Are men interested in this message? Well, I think though they couldn't articulate it, both men and women now very poignantly have realized that I say that which is not savored is easily confused, especially in the area of sexuality. So when we think of beautiful, wholesome femininity and of strong, courageous masculinity, those two things are created by God, and they're realities that are to be savored. When we as a church and as a culture don't savor them, then we leave them to the culture to do with them as the culture will. Now, I think the culture's line or the culture's general trend in the area of sexuality, masculinity, femininity has kind of started to spin out. I think you have a lot of young people who realize just how nauseating the outcomes are of a sexual revolution that began in the 1960s, but has now lost its novelty. Right. You know, the sexual revolution isn't a new thing anymore. If you're a Gen Z American, it's something that your grandparents and great grandparents did, and you're tired of the consequences. So what you have then, in particular for young men, is people going back to ancient sources, desperately looking for direction when it comes to masculinity. And, you know, I've only been working full time in men's ministry for 2 years now with Forge, but I've been working in ministry for over a decade. And I wrote, for example, Focus's resources on theology of the body. I've been speaking on issues as pertains to sexuality, both on the college campus, in the classroom, teaching at seminaries. And the number of times where I've given a talk and students stay for multiple hours asking questions, you know, that's happened to me, I don't think I'm exaggerating, hundreds of times, that people seem, especially young people, seem so hungry to speak on these topics, to probe their depths, to appreciate God's beauty as it pertains to sexuality, as it pertains to sexual complementarity, that is a really encouraging thing. And though my experience is somewhat anecdotal, recent sociological studies do seem to indicate that it's a broader cultural trend, and that is a reason for hope.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your talk. I loved the title that you gave it, God Made Man. I thought that was so beautiful because so much of the vilification of men has to be being internalized to an extent. And I think the church has done, and a lot of, you know, ministry leaders have done a great job of reminding us of the beauty and the dignity of woman, but we certainly need to be reminded of the sacred beauty of man too. So tell us a little bit about what you talked about and, you know, what was some of the reactions or questions or interesting feedback or vibes in the room that you had.
Yeah. Yeah. So God made men. Genesis 1:27, right? God created man in his image, male and female. He created them. God created humanity, male and female. And what I call the perfection of male and female raw material, which is masculinity and femininity, is something to be savored, as we've talked about already in this podcast. The route that I took in the talks at Seek, it basically followed along the lines of Pope St. John Paul II. John Paul II, who, of course, you know, originally spoke, but, you know, then it was delivered in written form, Theology of the Body, reflected obviously on sexuality, on the complementarity of men and women. But what a lot of people have kind of perceived about Theology of the Body is that Theology of the Body in particular and John Paul's thought in general seems a little bit more focused on all things feminine than it does all things masculine. And John Paul II is one of my heroes. On my desk here, I have a statue of him about, you know, 2 feet away from my microphone. I love John Paul II. So what I'm saying here is not so much critical of him and an appraisal of his character or anything like that. I mean, at the time, you know, 1979 to 1984, John Paul II was, you know, staring, you know, directly into the faces of the various different feminist movements in the culture, and he wanted to speak to them. You know, so he does things like the Letter to Women and Mulieris Dignitatem, and coins the phrase the feminine genius, and all of that stuff is so beautiful. But the culture has moved on to some degree since 1984, when Theology of the Body was complete. And I think what we're seeing around the planet, certainly in the Western world right now, is a rise of the question of man, perhaps to some degree more than the question of woman. And so what I did in the talk, though the college students might not have really seen it was I developed the thought of John Paul II on the topic of men and masculinity, kind of rounding out John Paul's thought in theology of the body. So, for example, we reflected on Genesis, on Adam in the garden, right? In the masculine way that he goes about extending God's work of creation, as all of the men in the audience are to continue extending his work of creation in their professions. We talked about how Adam, in his encounter with Eve, finds, in a way, kind of the meaning of his life. That although the things of the garden are certainly beautiful and they're certainly enticing and they're certainly good, and Adam is called to tend them and to cultivate them, that Adam isn't fulfilled as a human being until all of the things of his life, the plants and the animals in the garden, become about the person of his life, become about Eve. And in Adam, we see a kind of model for what masculinity ought to be, for how it was intended to be. And just to fast forward, and I know we don't have too much time today, in the remainder of the talk, I spoke about how, yes, Adam fell, but God, in his providential plan in the person of Christ, brings a new Adam. And in the Paschal mystery, in Christ's suffering, death, and resurrection, we see what redeemed masculinity can look like in today's world. It was astounding to speak about that. And if any of our readers are interested, check out New Adam anywhere books are sold. I'm not sure when this podcast will be aired, but it'll be released on February 16th. Check out New Adam, a book that I just published on this exact theme with our Sunday visitor.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jeb. As you mentioned at the outset, we need about 5 hours to really get through this entire topic. But thank you so much for giving us so much time today. And listeners, if you'd like to learn more about John Bishop, his book, New Adam, myforge.org would be your website. And then to learn more about us at the Catholic Association, you can visit thecatholicassociation.org to follow everything we do in radio, TV, print, online, and in our local communities. This has been Mary Fiorito.
And Ashley McGuire.
Thank you for joining us. Recent Sikh conference in Columbus, Ohio, which drew close to 19,000 attendees, Emily Wilson, a Catholic author and YouTuber, offered students a framework for approaching dating with clarity and purpose ahead of a speed dating event that was held at the Sikh conference on January 4th. Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I am your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And as mentioned, we are thrilled to have with us today Emily Wilson. She spoke to huge crowds at the Sikh annual gathering in Columbus about dating, and she herself is now launching a dating app called Sacred Spark after one of her social media posts went viral, recognizing the need for so many young Catholics who are anxious to find committed married love. Welcome to the show, Emily.
It's a great joy to be with you, and hello to all you listeners out there, wherever you may find yourself.
So, okay, we want to get down to brass tacks quickly here. We want to talk about this terrific event at Seek that you were part of. But first, can you tell us about that initial matchmaking post on Instagram that I think got close to 7,000 comments in about 48 hours? What happened there?
So after many years in ministry, as you and Betsy have probably been able to see yourself, it's a very challenging dating culture. This secular dating culture is a big, big mess. And single Catholics, I found over years, really struggle to connect and find one another because the church is so big. Many people attend churches all over maybe the state, and there's people who live nearby. But I thought, how can we do a better job connecting single Catholics? So very long story short, what I did was make what I called a matchmaking post on Instagram. And I said, this is a matchmaking post. If you would like to comment about yourself, say who you are, what kind of person you're looking for, or if you want to comment for your brother or your friend, you're welcome to do so. So yes, Mary, as you mentioned, in 2 days, there were almost 7,000 responses. And I have continued to do that over the past 3 years, I think it's been now. And there have been over 20 sacramental marriages, not dates, not phone calls, but marriages that have come out of those posts with two babies on the way from those beautiful couples. And it was just a little yes that felt like a really silly thing, but just my small attempt to really try to help single Catholics. Over that time, we saw social media is a little bit messy place. You might not be able to message someone if you're not following them. So I thought, let's make this official. And that's why my husband and I created Sacred Spark, which is a new dating and connections platform and matchmaking platform for single Catholics all over America.
And how would you say that it's different from other Catholic dating apps that or matchmaking apps that already exist?
Yeah. So what we did was we talked to many, many single people as we just researched and looked into doing this. And one of the things that they found they wanted to see more of was the human aspect of the person. We are all, as we know, the image and likeness of God, if we look in Genesis. And we wanted to, in the ways that you can in a digital space, highlight the humanity of people. So on Sacred Spark, you can make an audio introduction where you introduce yourself like you're at a gathering and you can hear someone's voice and the way they share about themselves. And you can also make a video. And this is one of my favorite things. So singles are making videos in their favorite spot in town. And they get to say in the video on Sacred Spark, hey, I'm Emily. I live in such and such a town. This is me downtown. One of my favorite spots. There are people who, for their hobbies, like a man who is in his woodworking workshop and he is there and he says, I'm Will. I live in Wisconsin. And these are the projects that I'm working on. So we really want to highlight the beauty of our singles, the beauty of their individuality, their individual nature in the way that you can in the digital space. That's so much more than just a picture where someone makes a, you know, quick snap judgment, passing on one photo. We want people to really come to life. And that's been a real joy to try to put together.
Well, you know, an article that I wrote fairly recently for First Things, it was before the conclave. And each of the authors as part of the series was asked to write about something that was sort of a challenge for the church. And I wrote about this topic, about the dating and marriage market among young Catholics. And I have two 20-something daughters myself, so I'm a little more tuned into this than some other parents might be. But I compared it to the Orthodox Jewish culture, which has, of course, a very, very strong commitment to marriage and to healthy families, and how they use, you know, matchmakers, for lack of a better word, to help organize not marriages. They don't have arranged marriages, but they have arranged meetings. And I've watched a couple of interviews with women who went through this. And, you know, one woman who's now, she's been married, I think, 40 years. But she talked about how the first person her parents arranged for her to meet, she said, after the second meeting, I said to my father, I don't like him. And my father said, okay, then you won't see him again. And I didn't. And she said, then the next boy, they knew his family. The matchmaker helped introduce, you know, the two families to each other. And after the second date, I said, Daddy, I like him. I'd like to see him again. And he said, okay. And then that wound up being the man that she married. So there's a real intentionality among the Orthodox Jewish community about not only marriage itself, but also stable, lifelong marriages where there's a lot of compatibility, like the different families get to know each other. And so that you knew you're starting off with that solid foundation that's very committed to a long-term lasting marriage. And there has to be something better, I argued, than, you know, we sending our 20-somethings out into the world onto dating apps where, you know, you don't know anything about this person's family or anything else. I see your idea, which is brilliant, as kind of a first step towards this. But tell me a little bit more about where you see this going in terms of more, not just getting people to be introduced to each other, but how do they have an understanding of the fundamental commitment that's going to be at the other end of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you're alluding to in the Jewish culture is support. And that is one of the biggest things. So many Catholic singles, I feel alone in this. I feel like nobody supports me. Like there's not a real good support, whether that's on a parish level of events for singles, right? We have many events for, you know, families or mothers, but that support is so essential for our singles at a foundational level, not even just in dating, but to give them ministries where they can thrive and be seen and known and accompanied on the journey, wherever that journey may take them. I really saw this in a beautiful way, going back to the matchmaking posts by friends or brothers or sisters who said, my brother Jeff, he lives in Indiana and he's 32. And how many marriages? I think probably half of the marriages that have happened came because two people set two people up. Right. And I think that's a really lost art in the Catholic Church. I think a lot of people have grown timid. They think like, oh, I don't want to overstep. I don't want to, you know, meddle too much in the life of my daughter or cousin or whoever it is. But I've just seen this boldness rising up in what you're referring to in the support of matchmaking. So logistically within the app to speak to that, you can have a matchmaker on Sacred Spark. I'm currently matchmaking for one of my friends. She's an amazing gal. And what a matchmaker can do is go in and they can send match requests to amazing men on my end as I matchmake for my friend that might be a good fit. And if there's a, if that man has a matchmaker within the app, the two matchmakers can correspond and say, tell me about Will and if he would be a good fit for my, you know, the gal that I'm matchmaking for, Jessica. And that support coming to life, hopefully on Sacred Spark. But I think long term, really, what we need to do is look at that foundational question of how can the church better support singles on their journey, helping them know how to date, learn how to date. We have a course through Sacred Spark that's totally free called Dating 101 to teach our, you know, young people, 20s and 30s, what does dating even look like? Because the culture has a lot of messages about what dating looks like and how it should proceed. But we want to get back to the real beauty of pursuit and masculinity and femininity and the way that we were created. I think building out that infrastructure, teaching single, well, first, supporting singles on their journey, no matter where it leads them. But second, teaching our singles how to date in a healthy way is going to be really essential for the health of dating in the Catholic Church in the long term. Would you agree, Betsy?
Yes, and I'm really interested in the getting into the weeds of what actually happens when people go on the app in terms of their profile picture.
Okay.
And also, let's talk a little bit of how people vet each other in terms of what they believe and what their practices currently are vis-a-vis their Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So can you share with us that process of being set up in the app?
Yeah.
And how people sort of do that initial dance of figuring out who's out there and how they might connect.
Absolutely. So there, we really want, as much as we possibly can, Sacred Spark to be a place for devoted, faithful Catholics who adhere to all the teachings of the church, right? There are so many different, you know, avenues by which people have gone down. Oh, I believe in this type of Catholicism or this type of Catholicism. We really want faithful Catholics who love the church, abide by the church's teachings. Does that mean they're perfect Catholics? Absolutely not. We're all sinners. We're all in need of God's grace. But when you go on to Sacred Spark, there's a couple, you can, there's an amount of photos that you can choose from, or video, right? You can make your video and your audio introduction in the onboarding process. And in the onboarding process, say for instance, right, it says, do you believe that sex is solely reserved in the bonds of marriage, between a man and a woman? And if you say no, I don't believe in that teaching, it will give you a prompt that says, this is the teaching of the church. And this is what the kind of culture that we want to cultivate here on Sacred Spark. And you need to know that and understand that before proceeding. It probably says that in less words that you can fit on a prompt. But these small ways that we really want to cultivate this culture of faithful Catholicism within Sacred Spark. There are only a limited number of ways that you can do that with, you know, an influx of tens of thousands of people coming on. But we've taken all the steps that we hope will help allow Sacred Spark to be that kind of place. So people make their audio introduction and then they can begin matching. There is a free version of Sacred Spark where you can match and message. And then there's also a premium version. If you want more features, you know, there's different things that you can do there. And then you can get going. And we've had an amazing amount of matches already. One of my close friends, she found a wonderful man that she's now in a committed relationship with on the second day that we were live. So it's been really a joy to see bringing singles together, which is the dream that we had when we began Sacred Spark in the first place.
You know, it's very reminiscent, Emily, of that class at Boston College that Dr. Carrie Cronin started called the Dating Project, one of the assignments, I believe it's the final exam, is you have to ask someone out on a date. A man has to ask a woman out and the date has to last 60 to 90 minutes. And the number of young people on both sides, men and women, who had never asked anybody out on a date before and who had never accepted a date that was verbally offered before. And how, you know, and I suppose probably social media has something to do with this. Kids don't interact in the way that they used to. You know, you don't walk down the block now and knock on the door and say, can John come out and play now? You know, when you're a kid, you text somebody or, you know, the mom set up emails. So that kind of natural human interaction
I just, that's my observation, is so lost. My daughter, had been going to a very traditional Catholic parish, and there was a cute boy she saw every Sunday, and every Sunday he would get one pew closer to her. But after 6 months, never asked her out, never asked her name, and she just kind of gave up and, went, started going to another parish, because she's like, after 6 months, if he can't even ask me what my name was. And I said, don't you approach him. He has to approach you. There have to, I do believe that there's some rules in dating, as old-fashioned as they might be. So I'm kind of wondering, like, in terms of the electronic part of this, I kind of see that as being almost an obstacle. And how are you addressing that piece of it?
Yeah, absolutely. We really are we in the digital space? Yes, but we do so, like in Dating 101, we talk about whether you're going to meet someone online, whether you're going to meet someone in person. These are, some kind of parameters that we should abide by, and men should, hopefully rise to the occasion. I told the men at the SEEK conference, even if the bar is really low, you don't have to act like it's that low. You can still act like it's high and behave in a way
Right,
that,
right.
as a man, you say, I don't care if the culture made the bar low, I'm not going to behave in that way, right? So looking at the digital spaces, and so many of our young people, as you and Betsy and I know, have grown up in this digital age, right? And so for them, communicating with people online has become too much of the norm, but is a normal part of the way that they connect. It's a normal part of the way that they connect with people. So
Right.
I think the obstacle that I'm seeing is that behavior for men, right? And I talked to the men at SEEK, and I said, take a risk, use the word date, go for it, just ask her out. Maybe she rejects you. Okay, she's not the right woman for you, but maybe she says yes. And then a couple of years later, after discernment and, the process, you're dancing under the stars with all the people that you love because she said yes to being your bride. You just never know. So the obstacle that, I think online is encouraging men, when they connect online with a woman, to take the initiative, to begin the conversation, to say, hey, I noticed this in your profile. I noticed that you've read 50 books this year. What was your favorite book? And really just starting that conversation. So while the digital spaces can present their own obstacles, and some people say, I'm totally anti-dating apps, period. I completely understand that. There are ways that we want to encourage men to be forthright, even in this age of digital connections.
So I want to recommend your Seek Talk to everyone because it was amazing. And I love the part where you begin with talking about going to an allergist and all the things you're allergic to. And you use it as a springboard to talking about vulnerability, which is a lot of what you just talked about with men and women not being willing to be vulnerable, which you have to be if you want to open yourself up in a relationship. So in that talk, you offered six principles for intentional dating, and I wanted to know if you would just share those with us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I told the young people in this dating talk, number one, go on one date and let other people go on one date. Don't make it too serious. Don't have your friend going out on a date and coming back and you say, so when are we sending out the wedding invitations? The second one was, for the men, use the word date and be very clear and intentional. And that goes for women as well. That note that I made about wherever the bar might be in the culture doesn't have to be where the bar is in your life. I told them, if God does call you to marriage and you leave college without finding your spouse, there is hope for you. So many young college students I talk to think, there's no, I won't find anybody if I graduate without a ring on my hand or without a fiance. And there's so much hope. And I offered them a number of stories of amazing people who have found their spouses either shortly after college or long after college ended. Number four, I told them, let go of the mindset that you will immediately think your future spouse is the most insanely attractive person you've ever met in your life, to just be open and not be so focused in on a type that I've created for myself, which will not allow me to be open to people who might not look like that type or seem like that type in dating. Number five, I told them to take care of their own heart, right? When we look at Philippians 4:7, when he says, then the peace of God that surpasses all understanding will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus, that often it takes hard choices for them to take care of their own heart and to guard their heart in dating. And that not very often people will do that for them. They have to make really hard choices to do that themselves. Number six was, I told them, You don't have to apologize for what your dating standards are or live in fear that they'll scare someone away. And I shared with them that being open and forthright is a gift that they can give themselves and a gift that they can give the other person, essentially, in dating. And one of the things I like to tell young people is if you had a dog named Fido and your life revolved around Fido, everything that you did really revolved around when Fido needed to eat or sleep or were just everything in your life, Fido was the epicenter. Would you not talk about Fido on the first date? Probably pretty passionately and with love. I said, your faith is the same. If you're a devoted Catholic person, your life revolves around that. And there are teachings of the church that you follow because that's the center of your life. Of course you bring it up on the first date. Of course you can talk about it passionately. Of course, if talking about Fido scares someone away who's like, I don't like dogs, all the better, because you have really moved to the next step of saying this wasn't the right person for me and I can move on in freedom and in peace. So those were the six things that I shared with them in a very short 30 minutes that I had to cover the entirety of dating as a whole in the year 2026.
Well, do you have any cautionary advice? I would think particularly for young women. I'm thinking of a younger woman I know who is a theology teacher at a Catholic school and went on a different Catholic dating app and was contacted by a man. They went on one date. It seemed to go fine. Second date, she was traveling to the city that this man lived in for a theology conference, as it happens. So she thought, I'll meet him at the hotel bar. That'll be a safe public place. And, you know, they had dinner and it was very nice. And then he said, would you like to go up to your room? And she said, what part of I'm a Catholic theology teacher at a Catholic school did you not get when I told you that? He goes, oh, like, were you serious about that? Do you like, and this is not a naive, this is a person with a PhD. She's not a naive person. And she was so crushed that this guy clearly had other intentions. And so I guess, you know, like anything else in life, right, you're going to have chaff mixed up with the wheat, and you have to you've got to be very aware of that as a woman, I think, in this day and age. Do you have any advice, just not to be suspicious of everybody, but also you've got to protect yourself, know your boundaries, right? How do you address that particular piece of it? I know I'm the skunk at the garden party here, but I just...
These things are very important.
Yeah, it is very important.
Yeah, what you said, a couple of important things, that when she was meeting this man, she made sure it was a public space. And it's really important if women are going on a date to let your friends know where you're going and, you know, to be in contact with people who you love and trust to let them know where you're going. I think this is something that I've heard from many women over the years, and I had a piece of writing on it a couple of years ago, when either a man or a woman says, oh, you were serious about that, right? Mm-hmm. And you are forced to double down to say, yes, I was serious about that. I am serious about that.
And it's almost always the woman who has to say that.
You are absolutely right. Yeah. Yes. And most of my ministry over these years have been with women who say, you know, the man thought that it was just something that I sort of believed, right? Whatever it is, no sex before marriage, or I will never use contraception in my life, in my marriage, within...
Or I'll never have an abortion if I get pregnant. That's another one.
All of these tenets that we believe as Catholics, right? For a woman to have to double down, but how important it is to double down to say, yes, I meant what I said, right? So going back to Dr. Seuss, I meant what I said, and I said what I meant. An elephant's faithful 100%, right? That to double down is sometimes necessary and sometimes a really important thing. And when you encounter a man who doesn't take your words seriously and thinks that you might be like just saying something to say it, that's a big red flag. And that's something to really pay attention to. A man who, right, that was not obviously the right man for her. But when someone says, you really meant what you said, it's really important to look at that with discernment to say, this person right out of the gate doesn't believe that I mean what I say. And it's really important to look at that with clear eyes to say, is this the kind of man or person or woman that I want to be involved with? And oftentimes the answer is no.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today. To learn more about Emily Wilson and Sacred Spark, please visit emilywilsonministries.com. And to learn more about us at the Catholic Association, go to thecatholicassociation.org to follow everything we do in radio, TV, print, online, and in our local communities. This has been Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
Thank you for joining us today.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by Monsignor Roger Landry. Monsignor, we've just had the end of a very special year that began and ended with the special doors in Rome that are only open once every 25 years. Can you give us a capsule summary of the highlights of that Jubilee year and what it meant?
So as you state, Betsy, Pope Leo on Tuesday, which is the Solemnity of the Epiphany in Rome, closed the Jubilee doors there in St. Peter's Basilica. In the week previous, the Jubilee doors at St. Mary Major, St. John Lateran, and St. Paul's Outside the Wall had been closed by the respective cardinals who run each of those basilicas. But it was Pope Leo himself who closed those beautiful doors that are now 75 years old. They're a door of mercy. They've got 16 panels on it. And in the first two panels in the upper left, it's the first sin, original sin, and the expulsion of Adam and Eve. And then in the top two on the right, it's the Annunciation and how Jesus is mercy in the world and the way that he exercised that mercy. He closed those doors, and doors are always super important in our faith because they symbolize a passage from one reality to another reality. And when we pass through the doors of a church, we're passing from our worldliness into a greater communion with Jesus, who is represented by his body, the church. And a physical church like St. Peter's is meant to symbolize the church as a whole. And that church of St. Peter's, we know, is literally built on top of the bones of Peter. And it's a fitting image of the church universal, which Jesus promised he was going to build on Peter the Rock. So when Pope Leo was closing those doors, he was closing this year of passage for us in which each of us was supposed to go from a situation in which we're not really living as much as we are by hope and giving witness to all who ask of the hope we carry within, to pass from that into a much greater and more hopeful way of living our faith. We've talked a few times over the course of the Jubilee of what hope really means. Hope means living with God in the world. We know that Jesus is with us, and that changes every situation, no matter how seemingly desperate, into a situation in which we know that we've got the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the Savior of the world, the Good Shepherd right at our side. And then the Catechism defines hope as as living for the kingdom of God and heaven, trusting in Jesus and his promises, and relying not on ourselves, but on the Holy Spirit. And so the Jubilee of Hope was meant to help us stoke our desire evermore to pass through the pearly gates of the heavenly Jerusalem. And so journeying spiritually, representatively here on earth is meant to inspire us on the pilgrimage of life through those celestial portals.
So people came and got a special indulgence for doing that. And there were also Jubilee churches around the world where that could happen. So for this not being a Jubilee year and people go to Rome, what other kinds of things can they do to get that same experience of entering from one world to the next, as you so described?
So the first thing is to grasp that our Christian life is a pilgrimage, that we don't have to pass through a physical door that has indulgences attached to it to live out that pilgrim reality. Every time we hear those beautiful words in Eucharistic Prayer 3 at the Mass, the church making her journey on earth, the pilgrim church on earth, as we translate it in English, we should be brought back to that reality. A couple of years ago, as you remember, I helped to lead the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage here in the United States of America, and it was to show all American Catholics not only that we are the pilgrim church on earth, making our journey here in the United States day by day, but that pilgrimage is a Eucharistic procession in which Jesus, God with us, still very much with us, journeys step by step along with us. And so for us to look intentionally at our life as where we go day by day, what the purpose of our life is, what its ultimate destination is, and we know that is supposed to be the outstretched arms of God the Father, then we're able to live every day differently. And so that's what I'd encourage. And we know the steps along that journey. It begins with prayer. It begins with Mass. It begins with confession. It begins with charity. You name it. These are the ways in which we're supposed to be strengthened by the graces of the Jubilee in order to live ordinary time reinvigorated.
Thank you once again for inspiring us to go forth with courage in our faith and with hope.
God bless you, Betsy.